Welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy podcast. Get inspired. Break through to new dimensions with your entrepreneurial peers on the journey of self-leadership mastery and life success. Reinvent or evolve yourself as you redesign your business. Dual innovation. Take charge of who you next become. Feel more deeply to think, act, lead, and mentor more clearly and more effectively. Learn something new from our conversation today.
This experience was thought-provoking. It was really fun. I thought about a couple things that I hadn't thought about in a little while, and I really appreciated it.
Welcome to We Mentor Mondays. I'm Nancy. In today's conversation, guest mentor Dan Oshinsky is here for a second conversation. Our first conversation was about his journey as a journalist and reporter, what he's learned after 10 years of blogging and 850 posts. And we added in a couple items for you to think about as you're building content strategy, which is consistency of what you're publishing and also building in healthy habits like writing something every day. Well, in today's conversation, we're going to talk about how Dan is building Inbox Collective and also how he drove 250 million clicks to BuzzFeed. I'm obsessed about that, Dan. Welcome to the program.
We can get into it. Yeah.
All right. So what's interesting also is you seem to find yourself in the right place at the right time because of your curiosity and your ability to notice and see opportunities to report on things. And when you got to joining BuzzFeed, I mean, you'd never led a team before, right?
I had done a little bit of work leading a team in Springfield, Missouri with Story.us. I had a team of five reporters that I hired, that I brought on, and I really liked managing a team. It was something that I had looked for. When I got to BuzzFeed, and again, some of this is, again, happy accidents.
Yeah.
At Missouri, I had noticed that a lot of the students were obsessed with BuzzFeed, which at that point was a website with lists and weird videos, and it was a lot of internet memes, and people didn't take it terribly seriously. And then we hired Ben Smith to be the editor-in-chief. He came from Politico and started hiring a team and doing news reporting. I had gotten there when they were in the process of bringing on a team to do long-form kind of magazine-style feature stories. I had reached out to them because it was a lot of what we'd been doing in Springfield, and I was just kind of curious what they were up to, what they were trying. We had a really nice conversation, and they went, "We like you, and you seem to make a lot of weird stuff on the internet, and a lot of the people who worked at BuzzFeed made weird stuff on the internet, so do you want to think about what kind of thing you could do here?" And I came back to them, and I had this newsletter we talked about last time, Tools for Reporters, where I shared tools that reporters could use, and I went, "This Tools for Reporters thing is great, because when I publish something on Facebook, nothing really happens, or Twitter, nobody responds. But when I send out a newsletter to 500 people write back, they talk to me, they invite me to have coffee or to a conversation. This newsletter thing, people seem to really react to. And BuzzFeed is all about telling stories that people wanted to share. Email was a great source of sharing on the web. It seemed to be a really good fit. So when I got to BuzzFeed, it was just me at the start. The first year was just me and a couple other folks who all pitch in on email design and strategy and data. And then in year two, we expanded to a team of three. And then in year three, we expanded to a team of five. And it just really grew from there. Again, some of it is happy accidents, though. BuzzFeed, I got there right at the moment. The company was about 175 people. And when I left after a little more than 5.5 years there, BuzzFeed had grown from 175 people to something like 1,500 employees in 20 offices around the world. So it helps when you get to jump onto something that is big, or that is, you know, small but growing quickly. I got there at exactly the right time.
Yes, because you are really great with your timing. And
I suppose it is a recurring theme at this point. So
yeah, that's right. You'll probably write about it tonight.
I actually, you know what? That is a really good blog post that I haven't really written about, but the right time. Actually, that's not true. I've written almost 1,000 blog posts. I've probably written a couple things about timing, but it is a real thing. Being in the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
I'll talk actually, my very first boss in San Antonio, I had two bosses, Greg and my boss, Jan Boyd, who was just the best. I love both of them. And I'm actually talking with her later tonight. We're going to catch up. And I remember she was someone, she had worked very early on in internet broadcast radio, broadcasting things over the air, it's broadcasting things that should have been over the air, but doing it over the web. But it was early on in the 90s, before people were ready for it. And I remember telling her, like, we had the right idea. It just wasn't the right time. And she was absolutely right. And there's things like this that happen. You go, this idea was so good. The team was so good. Why didn't it work? And sometimes it just wasn't the right time for it.
Yeah.
The technology wasn't there, or the audience wasn't there.
Right. Like they were ahead of their time.
Yeah. And it happens. I've been lucky in that a lot of the stuff that I've done has been the right thing at the right time.
Yeah, I think that's worth writing about because it's just an interesting thing that has really helped you build your career.
Sure.
Yeah. So while you're at BuzzFeed, wrote over 200 posts for BuzzFeed. You mentioned that only one hit 1 million views.
Yes, it's the one that is the most journalistic. It was the one that I would say when the University of Missouri Journalism School calls me up and says, tell our students about your fine work. They look at that one. It was the one that I wrote about Austin Powers' chest hair. For whatever reason, Mizzou has not called me back to speak at graduation. I don't know why. What couldn't the students learn from such a fine example? The reason I wrote a lot at BuzzFeed was the best way to get good at BuzzFeed and for us to be successful with newsletters, we had to be in a position where we understood the voice, understood the content. And so the best way to do that was to write and actually get feedback from the editors who would go, we like this, we don't like this, here's how you can make this better, so I could get into that right kind of BuzzFeed-y voice.
Oh.
So I wrote a lot, particularly at the start, because it was just such a good way to learn how to write for BuzzFeed.
Yeah, it sounds like a very unique skill set.
It was a very unusual voice that we had at the time. So it wasn't the kind of thing that everyone, it wasn't something that you could slip into. It was something you had to feel your way around and try it a bunch. And it was, this isn't quite right. This is, I'm trying too hard or I'm not trying enough. Eventually, you kind of just could slip into this voice. Oh, okay. This is what we sound like as an organization. But it took a while. It's a lot of writing. It's why I did so much of it.
Yeah.
It took me longer, I think, than most to figure out, this is how we sound. And for BuzzFeed, sounding like us, having the right voice was crucial because the audience could tell when someone was trying to fake it. Or they could sense other competitors who tried to sound like us, they tried to imitate us, and they weren't quite us. Yeah, it was something that was really important. That's why I did so much writing there.
And how instrumental were you in building out a team that was growing? Because you were, kind of your first role was director of newsletters. So I was thinking you probably were in charge of building out your team.
Yeah. Technically my first title was I was newsletter editor because there's only one of me. Then when we hired our second person on the team, they came to me and said, his name is Adam Davis. He's actually still at BuzzFeed and does amazing work there. And I said, well, Adam's going to be the newsletter editor. And they said, you're newsletter editor, so you need to figure out a new title. This was at a point where BuzzFeed was small and startup-y, so all the titles were made up. I'd say something like 75% of the editorial team had the title associate editor. It didn't really mean anything. It was just easier to give everyone a title and just say, here you go. Just start doing work. Don't worry about it. We'll figure out the titles later. And so when I said, Adam's going to be newsletter editor, they said, well, what are you going to be? I don't know. I said, well, figure out a title and come back to us. We didn't really have any vice presidents. So I wasn't going to be vice president of newsletter. That wasn't very BuzzFeed-y. But there was a director on the social media side. I said, could I just be director of newsletters? And I said, that's fine. The conversation was probably, I think it was one of those situations where it was probably 3 emails back and forth and took less than an hour. And they said, that's fine. That it didn't come with more, the title didn't come with more money, not necessarily much more responsibility. It was just, let's just get the title thing out of the way and we can move on from here.
And so over 5.5 years then later, how big did your team become?
So we grew at the most, we got to 5, but then we had folks in all these different departments who pitched in on email. So we had people on the news team, we had people in different offices in Sao Paulo and in Berlin and in Tokyo who did email, in Sydney, Australia who did email. So the whole email people, if when you count all the folks who were involved in email in some way, from our tech team, product and engineering, to data, to writers, there were probably close to 20 of us who were involved in email in some way, but 5 who directly reported into me. All they did was think about email all day.
Okay, I see. And how did you build the trust within the team and the respect and accountability, because you're constantly with deadlines?
So building trust with a team, it's a slow process. A lot of it was coming up with ways to handle stuff like one-to-one meetings. So the one-to-one meetings over time, when I first started doing them, they were my meetings. And by the end of my time at BuzzFeed, it was their meeting. It was very clear, like, this is your meeting. You are the one who, were, you know, you're going to use this time to figure out, what do you need help with? What kind of things are on your plate that I can help, I can assist with? What are the kind of things that I can unblock for you? Things are, roadblocks in your way. I want you to be, in charge and own this sort of time, which worked really well for my team because they were super independent. A lot of trust was finding ways to do little team building exercises and stuff that weren't team building exercises. So sometimes they were lunches. Sometimes it was giving people on my team the chance to present to a larger group or share strategies so they could own stuff and feel like, I have a real stake in this. I'm not just another person. I have a real ownership in the strategy. It was a lot of little things. We also just had, I got really lucky in that as we built the team, they were all, the 5 of us who were there, it was a creative bunch. They were very social. They got along really well with everybody. And I got really lucky in that respect.
Yeah.
And so some of it was just the luck of hiring really good, smart, creative, hardworking people who also happened to be unusually friendly. That was a really lucky break. But there's certain things, when I was in Springfield, Missouri, it was different. When I got the team, and that was also a team of 5 who worked with me. There were 6 total, including me. We got to Missouri. It was 5 reporters who had never met each other, who had all moved across the country for this kind of 4-month journalism experiment with no promise that it was going to go beyond 4 months. And I really told them, this is a 4-month thing. There's no more funding after this. You're coming here to get some experience, and then you're going to have to go out and get a real job after this. So I got a bunch of folks who were recent grads who said, yeah, this sounds like fun. And when they first came down, I remember thinking of all the cliched sports movies where, the team goes on the road trip or it's training camp. What's the thing that they do? They bond them all together. And so the first thing that we did when the whole team got down to Springfield was I took them to this park not too far from Springfield called Ha Ha Tonka Park. And we went on this hike as a team. We packed lunches and it was, probably 3 or 4 miles. And it's summer in Missouri, so it's 1,000 degrees and we're all sweating. And we kind of did this hike and we walked to this cave and then I gave them the pump up talk about what we're going to do. And I was so proud to have them. And at the end of this walk, they all hated me. They were all miserable and sweaty. Everyone hated me, and which was kind of the goal because I wanted them to have something at the end that had bonded them together. We all did this stupid walk at the end and it was 900 degrees. We went to this cave And why did we all commit to doing this thing? But I guess we're all in it together. And I had known that if they just had something that was in common, they would be, you just get the chance to meet each other and talk to each other, that hopefully they would like each other. And it worked. The other thing was that night we went to a con in the Ozarks for a band called Big Smith. Was a self-proclaimed hillbilly band, a bluegrass band, whose hit song was called I've Got a 12-inch three-speed oscillating fan. It is a song about a 12-inch three-speed oscillating fan. And this was truly a great band. Actually, I just saw on Facebook this week, they're reuniting for their 25th anniversary. They don't really tour that much anymore. The members are getting older. But a really fun band to play live. And so we saw them play live and at this in this field in Missouri, and it was really fun on this end of a hot, sweaty night. And you know, people at this concert are passing around jugs of moonshine, and everyone who was part of my team just went like, what did I sign up for? But they all had a great story at the end of it, and they all bonded over this, and we all got along. Sometimes you need to be a little more aggressive in, you know, the team building, and sometimes with BuzzFeed, it's just, hey, you put smart people in the room together and you give them chances to shine and give them chances to share their voice and let them do their thing, and it works out on its own.
Yeah. Wonderful. Sounds awesome. Like an experience you won't want to leave, but you found yourself in, what prompted you to realize it's time for me to move on? And then you ended up moving on to the New Yorker.
Yeah. It had been 5.5 years. I had done all the stuff that I had wanted to do at BuzzFeed. And when the New Yorker came, to be honest, it scared me because it was the New Yorker.
Right, yeah.
And that was a really exciting feeling. That BuzzFeed, I had done so much and been there so long, I was very comfortable. And the idea of going to this place, this institution, and being a part of their change, this digital transformation, was really exciting, but also really scary. And that, to me, was a draw because I didn't know if it was going to work. I was pretty sure it was going to work. But, yeah, you know, how would I fit in at the New Yorker? And people at the New Yorker, you know, they went to the best schools. And they use, frankly, people at the New Yorker have a far more advanced vocabulary than I do. And they're the people who do the Sunday New York crossword. I'm like a Monday and Tuesday New York crossword kind of guy. The New Yorker folks are Sunday folks. This is a bright group of people. And I was like, am I going to fit in? Is it going to be okay? And that was scary. And that's really what drew me to the job. Hey, I'm going to get to go to a place and I'm going to have something to prove. I want to prove that I can do this at the next level. And BuzzFeed was an amazing place to learn and grow. But the New Yorker felt like one of those opportunities. You know, I used to joke that it wasn't a dream job because I was never ambitious enough to think that I could have worked at a place like the New Yorker. That was never on the list of places. I was like, one day, I really hope I could work here. I was like, no, the New Yorker was way, way too ambitious for me. So getting the chance to work there, to meet that team and to work with that team, it was big and exciting and scary all at once. And so I just kind of knew that I had to say yes. I had to give it a try. I wanted to see if I could do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And at this time, where were you at in your personal life?
So I met my wife, Sally, a couple months after I moved here to New York, actually through a colleague of mine at BuzzFeed, a dear friend of mine, Sapna Maheshwari. She knew both of us and came to me one day and said, I know a Jewish person and I think you should meet her. And I'm Jewish and my wife is Jewish. And we both told her, you know, really, a Jewish person in New York? Congratulations. So we're delighted. I think we'll pass. And then she introduced us anyway, and it worked out great. But yeah, at that point, I had then met and married my wife. And we were at a point in the career where my wife had just moved on to a new job. She was a social worker at the time. Now she's a nurse. And Sally had taken a leap to a big new job at NYU. And she looked at me and went, well, I took the leap. You know, now it's your turn, too, to take the leap to the next big thing. Hmm. So, you know, having that person, too, Sally, is through all the stuff that I've done this last decade, has been not just, you know, not just a person I look forward to coming home to at the end of the day, but she's a cheerleader and she's someone who, when things are good, she, you know, she's there to support me and, you know, remind me, hey, enjoy it. Things are good. And when things are bad, she's there to say, it's going to get better. We're going to get through this. There's going to be better times. Yeah. She's really something.
A true partner. That's excellent. And how did you find your footing in your team? Because you took on the role of director of newsletters there again.
Was another case where when I got hired, they had never had a person like what had happened at BuzzFeed. They'd never had a person in this role before. They'd never had a newsletter lead. And so they said, what do you want to call yourself? And they debated a bunch of titles and they said, what if we just give you the exact same title that you have? And I said, great. Because honestly, I couldn't have cared less. It was the New York. Truly, it was the New Yorker.
Yeah,
come
right.
On. They could call it whatever title you want is fine, David Remnick. David, whatever you want to call me is okay. Do I get a paycheck? Do I get to come to this office? Their office is the World Trade Center. You're looking out over the Hudson River, looking out over the Statue of Liberty. Do I get to work in this building? Yeah, whatever you want to call me is great. I don't care. It's the New Yorker.
Yeah.
As long as the checks keep coming and I get to work here and work with this team, it really didn't matter to me. I am not particular about titles. I, you know, going back to story.us, I started it, make up your own title. And then at the New Yorker, you're the first person here, so you make up your own title. And then, or BuzzFeed was that. And then New Yorker, it's just here's whatever title. That's fine. I don't care. And now Inbox Collective, sometimes people, you know, Dan Oshinsky, president of Inbox Collective. I'm a one person operation. Who am I president of? It's just me. I'm just the Dan of this thing. It's just me. The titles really don't, to me, the titles are like, I'm just realizing this for the first time. The title, I feel about titles the way I feel about the design and look and feel of certain things like the Google Doc. Like, I don't really care. Just whatever is fine. Let's get on to the good stuff, which is the content.
Yeah, right.
Let's get on to the work.
Yes, exactly. Okay. That's a good descriptor of yourself. So how big was your team and how did you build that team out?
Very different sort of team. So that was one where at BuzzFeed, we really only had one goal with newsletters, which was to get as big as possible, as quickly as possible, and drive as much traffic back to the website. So we launched all sorts of newsletters. It was never about having just one big newsletter. We launched, our big breakthrough was thinking about specific audiences. So, hey, you know, there's an audience here that's really interested in long form writing that wants like a Sunday sort of magazine every week. Let's build something for them. Hey, there's an audience over here that wants DIY content. Let's build something for them. Mm-hmm. Here's an audience of parents. Let's build something for them. And building lots of different products and trying to target them and saying, hey, we built something just for you. That worked. At the New Yorker, the goals were more a little bit more advanced because it wasn't just about driving traffic, but driving revenue. Hey, we're trying to build a subscription base. The New Yorker is built almost entirely on subscription revenue. If readers stopped paying for the New Yorker, it couldn't exist. It couldn't exist with just advertising. So the goal there was, Dan, let's build an audience and get these people to pay for the New Yorker. Because if they pay for the New Yorker, then we can make more of the New Yorker for them. And so there was a little different because I worked with editors and writers. I worked with our consumer revenue team, who are the people who get you to pull out your credit card and pay for a subscription. I worked with our tech and engineering folks, with our data team. We had an audience development team, which was all about, you know, how do we get more people to the website and keep them on the website and the analytics side of things. We had teams that dealt with events like the New Yorker's annual festival. Mm-hmm. We had a team devoted to merchandise. You can go on the New Yorker store and buy, you know, covers and cartoons and mugs and all these sorts of things. So there were just a lot of different people to deal with. So that was different. At BuzzFeed, we built kind of a central team and I sort of owned it. At the New Yorker, I was the hub of email and there were a whole bunch of different spokes pointing towards different parts of the organization. Mm. So it meant that I had to build the strategy and then get other members of the team to buy in on the strategy and figure out how what they were working on could align with what I was working on. Mm-hmm. And definitely make sure that they understood my goals and vice versa, we couldn't have a situation where they were working towards something and I was working on something completely different or something that might counteract or work against their strategy. So it wasn't so much building a team as building a coalition.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Yeah, because that's a lot of people to kind of get buy-in from.
It was. I think in a certain way, I watched the movie Office Space the other day on a plane.
Okay.
And there's the line in Office Space about, you know, when I get in trouble with the TPS reports, I have 8 different bosses reporting into me. There was a little of that at the New Yorker. It was like, not so much me getting into trouble, but I would say something and then I'd say it again. And then I would find myself saying it for about the 12th time. I'm like, oh yeah, there's a lot of people I had to tell about this. This one little thing had to be communicated off to a lot of different folks. And that was part of the fun of it. It was a big organization and building that structure, building, you know, the sense that, hey, we're working together on this mission was really fun. I liked that part of the challenge. Mm. It was an organization that I think historically had been a little bit siloed. Editors worked on one floor and people on the consumer revenue team worked on another, and they didn't really mingle because they had very different jobs. And one of my roles was, hey, we need to work together towards this thing. This all works together. You know, if we're not all rowing the boat in the same direction, this magazine is not going to work in the long run. So it was fun to be a part of that because I was one of the many folks who were trying to take on those responsibilities and say, let's move towards this big goal together. Let's figure out how we can work together.
Yeah. So that was the biggest challenge.
Yeah. Yeah. That and trying to keep up with the vocabulary that New Yorker editors used. I found myself every once in a while, someone would say a word out loud. I've never actually heard someone speak that word aloud before. My goodness. Very bright group of editors, but just the love of one of the loveliest groups of people that you'll ever meet. They care. So you can tell when I look at the magazine now as an alum of that place, but also a fan, you can tell how much care and love they put into it.
Yeah.
It, I think, shows in the publication. It's a really special and really unique thing. And just to be a part of it for a couple of years was such a joy and such a privilege.
What made you decide, well, now it's time for me to launch my own business, Inbox Collective?
This is not going to surprise you, but there was a little bit of luck involved in all of this.
You seem like the luckiest guy on earth.
I feel like it a lot of days. I have a lovely wife. I have a lovely life. I'm talking to you and looking out over New York City right now, it's really not so bad. In January 2019, and this is a lot of stuff in my life has come full circle. So I had Tools for Reporters, where I shared, you know, tools that I thought other reporters would use.
Yeah.
And then I started looking around and going, you know, there's not really a place for people like me who do this stuff with email. When I first started at BuzzFeed, I went around to all these different publications, you know, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, these big outlets. And I went, can I talk to your newsletter editor? I want to talk to them about their strategy, figure out what they know so I don't do that same stuff. And everyone just said, oh, we don't have anyone who does that. My job didn't really exist. It does now, but it didn't at the time. And then over the years, people would get that job and they would reach out to me and they would go, I just got this job of the newsletter editor. I don't really know what I'm doing. Can we have coffee? And I kept getting the same questions over and over again. You know, how do I grow my email list and what kind of email products work and what do I need to know about email deliverability? Or it was the same questions. And I just thought, oh, you know, I should have a place like Tools for Reporters where I can share stuff that I've learned and stuff that I'm learning, what I'm reading, what I'm thinking about, tips and tricks. Let me build a space for these other folks who keep asking me this stuff. I should do more to help. And I didn't really see anyone else trying like something like this. So I thought, well, I'll be the one to build it. That's kind of my nature. Mm-hmm. And so I started it as a Google Doc for two main reasons. The three reasons. One was that it was really easy to publish. I had been writing it already in a Google Doc. So all I had to say was, let me turn this setting from private to anyone can view and share it with some friends. So it made it really easy to get started. Two was I knew that Google Docs at a place like the New Yorker and BuzzFeed was how we worked and shared things. So I thought there was a chance that people would go like, oh, it's this like working, living memo document thing that I'm reading and other people are reading. We're all learning from, and you can share it with your colleagues. And then the third thing was I was a little worried that if I published something that seemed too official, Condé Nast would freak out. Condé Nast is a big, you know, it's a big company. They have a big corporate structure. They have a big HR team, all these sorts of things. And I thought, if this seems like I'm trying to launch, and I didn't ever intend to launch a company, I just thought I'll publish stuff. But I thought, you know, if this seems like a real website, I might get some weird pushback. I might get questions from various bosses or editors going like, what is this? What are you doing exactly? And they might say like, you're not allowed to do that. You have to focus on your job. And I figured if it was a Google Doc that nobody would take it all that seriously, which was right. They kind of looked at it and went, we don't really know what this is. So yeah, you can keep doing this. This is fine. It's great. That sounds great. So I launched in January of 2019. It was a Google Doc where I wrote about some stuff in the email space and shared some stories. And then I had an email alert that people could sign up for. I said, hey, if you want to be notified when the next one goes out, sign up and I'll email you when I publish the next one. And I told my wife, I said, if I get 10 people to sign up for the Google Doc, sign up for the email alert, I'll do another one of these. I was hoping that I thought 10 people seemed like a pretty nice goal. You know, an email list really goes slow. 10 people seems great. If I get 10 people, that's fantastic. It's just a weird Google Doc thing. And 400 people signed up in the first 72 hours.
Wow.
So I was like, I shared it with, there's a couple different Facebook groups and email communities that I'm a part of. So I shared it with those groups and I said, hey, I'm writing this thing. I hope you like it. You know, sign up for more. And then I shared it with some friends and they all shared it with their friends and apparently their friends too. And they all signed up and I went, oh, I guess people want this. Okay. I guess I'll do more of these. And then over the next couple of months, people would reach out and go, you know, we're looking for a person who could help us with our email strategy. We have some budget to do this. We have some money. We're just not sure who the right person is. Do you know who could help us? And I would say, no, I'm really sorry. I wish I knew, yada. And then at some point, my wife said, you know, over the last couple of months, you keep coming to me and saying, all these people are showing up at your door saying, I have a bunch of money and need to hire somebody, looking for someone who knows a lot about email. I think they're just asking for you. And you're in there. You know, I was like, are you sure? And she's like, yeah, I think they're just, you know, they know you have a full-time job. They're asking if they can work with you. They're just trying to be polite about it. It's like, oh, I guess that makes sense. And then I started to think about it. I went, you know, there've been a lot of people who keep showing up asking like, really enjoy your writing. Do you know who can help us out? Actually, I think you're right. I think a lot of people do want to hire me. And so then we had the conversation of like, am I crazy enough to quit my job at the New Yorker to go help these people who keep asking for help? I was never really looking to quit. I liked my job at the New Yorker. It was great. It was a lot of fun. I liked what we were building. But this also seemed fun and exciting. And like when I left the New Yorker, or like when I left BuzzFeed, it was a little bit scary too. You know, is this going to work?
Yeah.
And that was really exciting. And the more that people sign up for my email list and I started to have conversations with them about, you know, what are you struggling with? Where do you need help? I realized, oh, this is how I can be of most help to the industry. The New Yorker is going to be fine and is. They're doing great. They're doing awesome stuff with email. Their daily newsletter looks fantastic. They're just crushing it. I wasn't worried about the New Yorker at that point. They were in a good place where someone could pick up the baton and run with it.
Yeah.
But I started to look at the rest of the industry and go, there's a lot of other people who need my help. This could be a way for me to do it. And so that's where Inbox Collective came from. Really, the audience just asking over and over again, Dan, can we pay you to help us? And me eventually going, oh, I guess, yeah, that would be okay by me, sure.
So what are your aspirations for this year? Are you thinking about building a team?
It's a really good question. So Inbox Collective for the last, well, it's coming up on 3 years. It'll be 3 years this summer. In August is officially when I left the New Yorker. And 3 years, you know, almost 3 years in, it's exceeded all my expectations, the types of clients I've gotten to work with, the way I've gotten to help, the travel I've gotten to do, and talks I've gotten to give over the years in a bunch of different countries.
Nice.
And it's all been great. The next step here, there's really two things. One is trying to figure out how I can take what I've done with the Google Doc and expand it. So I do regret to say this, but inboxcollective.com in the not too distant future will cease to be a Google Slide website and will become an actual website, you
okay,
know, with like
good.
Links and pages and
yes,
all that kind of
yes.
stuff like a real person would have.
Yeah. good.
And like you have right now, a real website that people can visit. And so
it works well,
that's going to happen because I started looking back through this catalog of stuff I've written and just went, there's a lot of good stuff here that I published, but I publish a Google Doc every month. Hey, it's the February edition of Not a Newsletter. I look back and go, that thing I wrote last February is still pretty useful, but people can't find it because I publish it and then it goes away.
Yeah.
Hey, you know what? I should have a place where I start to share more of this stuff. There's no reason why someone should be punished because they didn't see something that I wrote a year and a half ago. Hey, it should live on the web like a normal article. So building out the Inbox Collective website is the big thing for 2023 or 2022. And then
good.
I do think I'm getting closer to the point where I'm going to hire somebody to work with me. For a while, especially during the pandemic, it's been tough to say, yes, of course I should grow. Because I don't want to. For me, growth is not about, it's not tied to money. It's not about, you know, should I hire somebody because I think I can scale the business and make, you know, if I hire two people, I can 5X the revenue. It's not that. I'm not like an entrepreneur from Shark Tank or something. This is not an episode of How I Built This where I'm telling you how I built like a company that's on the NASDAQ or something like that. Like the money is not that important. It's about the impact is if I bring on somebody, can I, you know, 3X the revenue? It's can I, you know, 2X, 3X the impact that I have? Can I work with more people? Can I take on more projects? Can I start to take on different sorts of things like workshops or, you know, on-demand email classes where I can teach people stuff that I've learned? Can if I have someone helping me or multiple people helping me, can I invest that time back into other things that I think will help this community and help this audience? And so I'm starting to come around on the idea that, yeah, I think if I had somebody on to help me out, I might be able to do more to support the people who read this thing and need help. I'm not there yet. I got some stuff to take care of, but I wouldn't be surprised if at the end of the year I'm in a place where I say, okay, I think it's really time to hire and maybe grow a little bit.
Well, and with the business that you've founded, Inbox Collective, it's broad enough, so it gives you lots of creative room for you to explore all kinds of projects under the same umbrella. Because your desire to start something new and get it up and running and solid, a foundation under, the person that you bring in won't have that same desire. They'll have a different skill set, right? Like you mentioned with Samantha. You know, with your tools for reporters. You know, she didn't have the startup skills. She had the next level of skills. So, you know, I would just suggest exploring the arena that you're in, right? Under your business umbrella and see where you can build out some different things for your infrastructure because you've got a lot of success behind you. Yeah.
I think that's absolutely right. Because for me, it's not, you know, I have no intent of going anywhere right now. This is not a case where I'm saying, oh, at the end of this year, this isn't like tools for reporters. Ah, I've done it for a couple of years. I'm going to hand it off and leave. It's not all. I have a lot of work to do here with Inbox Collective and helping people who need help with email. And
I think you could spend, you know, 20 years to 30 years exploring that and building it
up. Oh, my goodness. For me, the idea of thinking that far down the road. I know you with the work that you've done.
Well, I'm a little older.
It's been a multi-decade kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I look at that and go, wow, that's amazing. But I can't, I mean, did you think if we were having this conversation where you would have been, you know, 3 years into building your business, would if someone had said, you know, what does the business look like in 20 years? Would you have thought, oh, I'll definitely be doing this in 20 years?
No, well, I did know that WeMentor was a big, and I knew that whatever I wanted to create, and I was, as far as content, I was interested in curriculum. You know, I was a professor at a couple of universities and had to write curriculum and was running groups and doing individual work. And so I've always, too, been concerned about the content and not wanting to be confined. So I knew that WeMentor would be, we would journey together. I just didn't think I'd be in business, you know, 30 years now. So, yeah,
it's amazing. The idea of that sort of longevity is so cool. Who knows? I don't know. I mean, email moves relatively slowly. People ask, you know, is email going to be around forever? I don't know. Forever is a real long time. I don't know what forever looks like. I don't expect email going anywhere in the next couple of years. I think email's... Yeah.
Email has been around for, you know, a really long decades, you know, since...
Sure.
So it's like there's... And the inbox possibly could change, you know, to some other medium, but you've got the inbox collective, you know.
Yes, the collective implies that at some point in the future, if the inbox changes, actually, that would be a great slogan. As the inbox changes, we change with it.
Yeah.
Inbox Collective.
There it is.
I'm gonna steal that right now for 15 years from now when we're all reading emails on contact lenses that Microsoft has produced for us and whatever the future is, when we're all working on the moon, Inbox Collective.
Well, and the reason I'm telling you this also is because of the experience that I have. Like, had I known what I know now, right, I would have built a different type of infrastructure, but it would have had more legs. And I can see in you the creativity and the exploration. And now that you've landed in your own business, all the skills and different experiences you can harness and pull together in a way that can help you package it for a long period of time to satisfy your creativity and not outgrow the opportunity.
Yeah. Thank you. I really appreciate that.
You're welcome.
One more thing, which is, at the start of this, the conversations that I had, I got really lucky. I met a few dozen people who had done businesses like this, kind of solo consultants, indie consultants.
Yep.
The only types of consultants I'd ever really met before 2019 were people who worked at places like McKinsey. And I was like, oh, that's what consultants are. Like, they're, you know, some big company like Condé Nast comes in and hires them for stupid amounts of money to come and give these presentations, and they all wear the suits and they have their fancy slide decks. And I was like, that's what consulting is. And was shocked to find out there were people who do the thing that I do now, which is like, no, I'm like a one person or two person operation. It's small. I try to get real personal and help with folks. I try to make a difference in the day to day in a different way. Not that the McKinsey people don't, but it's a different sort of work.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so it was so exciting to meet people who'd done this, to ask them questions. You know, again, trying to be curious, how did you do this? Why did you do this? What, you know, how did you charge? Even things like, literally, it's like, I don't know what people charge for this. I don't know how much money I'm supposed to ask people for. What is an hour of your time worth? Yeah. I have no idea. I can use the number that I make at, you know, the New Yorker, but then that doesn't count. That doesn't count health insurance. It doesn't count the cost, the quality of my time. That doesn't count the fact that I'm not working 40 hours a week that are on the clock.
Yeah.
I had no idea. So having just so many conversations helped shape, okay, here's how to charge. Here's the kind of work that you can do. Here's different opportunities. Here's how you build this thing. And now it was one of the reasons I was excited to chat with you today. Now the next stage is starting to meet and have conversations with folks who have built things that have lasted a long time, that have grown a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay. Well, you know, I know that I'm not the first person to ever attempt to build a business. I don't need to try to invent something from scratch. I can learn from what other people are doing. So make sure that I'm making time to ask, to be curious, to listen. And then hopefully over time, a couple things will stand out and go, okay, if I'm going to build this business and I'm going to take it to the next level, it's going to grow to to 2 employees, to 3 employees, if we're going to branch out into other content areas, if we're going to try different ways to help, here's what might be on the table. Here's how I might be able to tackle something like this. I'm still figuring it out, but I feel like every month I get a little bit closer to being to having a sense of, oh, I think I see what the next 2 to 3 years of this thing looks like.
Yeah, and have one big goal with your operational part per year, I would suggest.
What do you mean by that?
Well, like with your website, you know, it's how can I get that to a place in which it really reflects the depth of work, but also can inventory, and you can have different categories, you know, of where the newsletters fit.
Yeah.
You know, with a multiple number of categories, you can also do it monthly, but the infrastructure of the website, and then what does it take to run the website consistently? Do I need a person in there who's handling that, or can I build that out this year, see what it's like to do the work to keep it, maintain it, and then you know when you're paying someone for it, you know what the value is.
Yeah, I like that a lot. Have you ever considered starting any sort of business with advice and coaching for other folks? You'd be great at it.
Oh, thank you very much. Wow. Oh, God. Oh, very good. Well, this has been a delightful conversation. You know, is there anything about email newsletters that people should keep in mind, or things they should stop doing, or, you know, with newsletters that don't work?
So the best advice I can give you on email is just remember that it's a really personal space. If you look at your own inbox today, you know, right now you're listening to this podcast and you can do this. You can multitask. You're on your phone, pull up your inbox and look through it, and you'll notice, you know, who's in there. It's your family. It's your friends. It's your coworkers. It's maybe a couple of brands or news organizations or nonprofits, some people you like. And you make time for them. And the inbox is, it's kind of a living room. It's this personal space where you choose and say, hey, I want to let these people in. And so when you think about it that way, you realize, well, if I am going to get into that space, I have to not just convince them to let me in, but then I have to earn my place there. I have to keep my place in the inbox. And so... so many of the tactics that I see when I see bad email senders, when I see people doing shady sorts of things, trying to trick people into opening emails with kind of clever subject lines or, you know, shady sorts of subject lines or tactics, what I think about is, okay, well, you convince them to open the door and they're in. Why do you think that person is going to let you stay? You know, if this was really a living room.
Yeah, that's what I think.
If someone tricks their way into your living room, you're not going to be like, well, why don't you put your feet up and stay a while? Like, get out of my house. I don't want you here.
Right.
You don't belong here. Leave.
Yeah.
You know, you can't stay. And so the more you think about it is email is a long-term relationship. You have to earn your place. You have to keep your place. The more you start to think, well, if I'm going to send an email, it better be good.
Yeah.
The content better be good. Whatever I promise them up front, I gotta, you know, over deliver on that. I have to give them really good stuff. And so with email, the more you think about it as a personal space and a long-term relationship, the more you start to think, well, what's best for this relationship? How am I going to, you know, share something with them today that's going to be useful and that's going to make them say, this is great. I can't wait until Dan or Nancy or Mike or whoever writes back the next time with something else. And yeah, think about the long-term relationship there. Think about the living room. The more you do, the more you tend to build stuff for the long haul, and think about email as a long-term relationship.
Beautiful. Well, this has been a delight. You have been totally just lovely and insightful, and I really appreciate your journey.
Well, thanks for having me. It's really been a lot of fun. It's been such a pleasure.
Good. And thank you for tuning in and listening. And thanks, Mike Abeas, sound engineer, videographer, photographer, mon frère de notre mère, brother from another mother. And we'll see you next week. Do you want to build upon your leadership skills and become effective as a business owner? Do you want to evolve yourself as you redesign your business? You can. We know that dual innovation with mentoring works. We've mentored thousands of emerging to experienced entrepreneurial leaders and small business owners in this dual innovation process since 1992. We are here to co-create a mentoring process where you can nourish resilient relationships while you redesign your business. Resilient relationships promote relational literacy, the ability to understand and express healthy ways of relating. Even a slight increase in relational literacy can lead to significant improvement in all of your relationships. So why not take the risk to move out of dysfunctional relating and move into ways to deepen your connection to yourself and others? Assert self-leadership. If you aren't already subscribed to this podcast, go do it now. Go to wementor.com and get the support and skills needed to build a purposeful life journey with your peers on the entrepreneurial leadership path, consciously co-creating our future. You can also join our virtual mentoring community for one-on-one strategic mentoring or participate in a WeMentor lab, because we mentor meaningful conversations and activities that lead to higher levels of functionality and engagement in our world and everything that we do with each other. So engage your curiosity and become the leader you envision yourself to be today. WeMentor.com. Go there. Check it out.